still not reunited today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. A mother is deported to Guatemala without her young daughter and doesn't know when she'll see her again.
If anything was ever to happen to me, I won't be able to see Maria again. Like if I end up dying.
Also, President Trump suggests those who enter the U.S. illegally could be deported without a hearing. U.S. law says otherwise, but...
Could theoretically Congress say that anybody who's caught illegally in the United States at any time is automatically deported? They could say that.
Plus, India has no team at the World Cup, but this soccer fan in Kolkata has a soft spot for Argentina star Leo Messi.
The Argentinian team is my life. I love Messi. He's like my big brother.
Those stories and much more, just ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Family separations at the border remains the big story today. President Trump promised to end his administration's policy of splitting up kids and their parents when they enter the U.S. without authorization, but it's still not clear how they'll house these families. And though some have been reunited, many still remain apart, like Magdalena and her daughter Maria. Earlier this month, Ashley Cleek told us about a Guatemalan mother and daughter who were separated at the border. That happened last August. We asked Ashley to give us an update, starting with some background on the family.
Magdalena and Maria, they lived in like a very small village in the Guatemalan highlands with Magdalena's parents. And Magdalena was being threatened by a man she calls Juan. He was Maria's stepdad, and Magdalena was sexually and physically abused by him. And I think the final instance was he came to their house with a gun and threatened to kill Magdalena if she didn't come with him. So after that, the mom and the daughter packed up and headed to the border. They crossed around the Rio Grande and were immediately apprehended by Border Patrol. It was in the early stages of this policy, so they were kept at the border for about 2 nights. And then one morning, people from the Department of Health and Human Services came and took Maria and some other kids to New York in like a government shelter. Magdalena was charged with a misdemeanor, crossing the border illegally without documents, and she was sent to jail for 2 weeks.
So it's now almost a year later. Where is Maria now?
So Maria is living with a great aunt in Florida, and she seems like she's okay. I mean, she's going to school. She sounds excited. And also, Maria is in asylum proceedings by herself. Magdalena was kept in detention for 6 months and deported in January. She's back in Guatemala living with her older brother in his house because she's really scared of the reason that they left, this man named Juan. So yeah, she's kind of hiding in her brother's house.
Now, has Magdalena spoken to her daughter, Maria, recently?
So I just called Magdalena yesterday. And of course, this is all through an interpreter because Magdalena and Maria both speak Acateco. It's an indigenous Mayan language. So Magdalena asked Maria how she was doing. They try to check in 2 to 3 times a week.
I spoke to Maria on Friday, and she said she was doing well. Maria asked when I was going to go see her, and I said I wasn't sure. There's no date for us to see each other. And Maria mentioned that she doesn't want to go back to Guatemala.
So, Ashley, we're now at a different point. Last week, President Trump signed an executive order ending family separation at the border, although the zero-tolerance policy is still in effect. How is Magdalena reacting to that?
You know, she really didn't know about it at all. I asked her about it multiple times, and she hadn't heard the news. She said that she was just still hearing that families were being separated. So she hadn't heard of it.
Does Magdalena have any regrets about the situation she's in now? She's back in Guatemala, but her daughter is in the U.S.
I mean, I think she misses her daughter deeply, but it's a dangerous situation. I think she really fears for her life. So I think she's glad that Maria is safe. You know, I asked her about this, and this is what she said.
I get sad that I can't be with my daughter. If anything was ever to happen to me, I won't be able to see Maria again. Like, if I end up dying.
That really surprised me when she said that. I didn't realize the threat was so imminent again. She's only 25, and she's really worried about being killed.
What's next for Magdalena? Does she have any plans to try and reunite with her daughter in the U.S.?
No. You know, when I initially talked to her, she said that she was going to come back when I talked to her yesterday, we really talked about the financial situation. She still owes money from the first trip that she made to coyotes who helped her and Maria get to the border. And then if she wanted to come back, it's a lot of money. It's around $6,000, $5,000. She doesn't have that. There's not really like a clear legal path to the U.S. at this point. If she came back and she crossed the border again, it would be a felony. So there's no plans for her to come to the U.S.
Reporter Ashley Cleek in New York. Thanks a lot, Ashley.
Thank you so much, Carol.
Over the weekend, President Trump took to Twitter to make this point. Quote, when somebody comes in, we must immediately, with no judges or court cases, bring them back from where they came from, end quote. It's not entirely clear whether the president also had asylum seekers in mind when he made that statement, but we wanted to know what due process rights look like for all people crossing the U.S. border without authorization. So we reached out to Charles Cook. He's an immigration attorney based in Atlanta, Georgia.
Due process currently exists for asylum seekers. So somebody comes across the border illegally, is caught or turns themselves into a Border Patrol agent and says, I want asylum. What they are allowed to have, one, is an interview by an asylum officer to determine whether they are believable, whether your claim could be real. And that's granted well over 90% of the time. And then at that point, they have a right to have a hearing in front of an immigration judge on the actuality of their claim. Is their claim not only credible, but do they have a reasonable fear of persecution in their home country based upon one of five statutory and treaty-based grounds? Those are only granted, generally speaking, 20 to 30% of the time, depending on what country they're from. And that's the limit of their due process. They do get to appeal that, of course, to an appeals court, but they can be deported while that appeal is pending if a stay is not granted by the court.
And what about those entering the U.S., picked up by Border Patrol or border agents, and they are not applying for asylum? What sort of due process are they guaranteed at this point, and practically how does it work?
Their due process is essentially non-existent. It is consists of only a low-level immigration officer and their supervisor determining that that person is either coming to work illegally or doesn't have proper papers. And they can then be turned around immediately, usually within 24 hours, deported from the United States without a hearing, with no right to a hearing, with a bar to coming back for 5 years. And that's been the law since 1996.
What laws stipulate that those seeking asylum get due process?
The reason why asylum seekers are exempted from the immediate removal from the United States is because of our international treaty obligations. The United States has a long history prior to the signing Refugee Convention in 1967 of turning away asylum seekers. We had turned away boatloads of Jews during World War II, and we didn't want to go back to that time. So our laws, as we treat asylees coming into the United States and refugees outside the United States, is controlled both by international law and by the U.S. law interpretation of those international treaty obligations. It's not something we can simply ignore.
So is what Donald Trump is suggesting even possible, to simply turn people around and send them back?
President Trump's tweet is based upon an ignorance of the law that currently exists and is more a sales pitch than it is an actual policy of any kind. Could theoretically Congress say that anybody who's caught illegally in the United States at any time is automatically deported? They could say that. I don't think the Supreme Court would uphold that, particularly for people that have long-term residence in the United States, even if it was undocumented. But certainly for people at the border, they could say that if you really want asylum, you have to apply outside the United States, but that contradicts the basis of asylum, which is people presenting themselves at the border, and we clearly violate our international treaty obligations.
Charles Cook is an immigration lawyer. He spoke to us from Atlanta. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
5 more years. That's what Turkish voters gave their incumbent President Recep Tayyip Erdogan yesterday. And it's an even more powerful position since last year's change to the Constitution. For the past few years, Erdogan has been tightening his control over Turkey, overseeing a crackdown on perceived critics. And right up to yesterday's election, there was speculation Erdogan might be losing popularity. But in the end, he won an outright victory at the polls with 53% of the vote. I asked reporter Borzu Dargahi what Erdogan's win and so-called executive presidency mean for Turkey's future.
Well, domestically, I got to say, I don't know. You know, frankly speaking, I'm like a very close observer of Turkish politics, and he's been acting like an executive president for like a couple years now. I don't think that, you know, the judiciary really seems to be acting independently of him. I don't think any of the institutions in the country, in terms of the government, are independent of him. He seems to be running everything without any kind of checks and balances. Where it might make a difference is without the worry of an election, it might possibly give him the space to moderate his policies a little bit. That's the optimistic scenario. And where it might make a difference also is on the foreign policy stage. This victory gives Erdogan more power to make ambitious moves on the foreign policy arena. What does that mean? Doing what he wants in terms of aligning with other countries, Russia, Iran, taking a more adventurous stance in neighboring Syria. So this executive presidency doesn't seem to give him a lot more power domestically, but it does give him a little bit more authority and leeway on the foreign policy front.
What about the crackdown on dissent that followed the failed military coup 2 years ago? Is that still going on?
It hasn't gotten worse in recent months. Actually, the election season sort of opened up the political space. And there was quite a lot of criticism of Erdogan and his policy and his party. But I don't see good things on that front. I see Turkey continuing its authoritarian drift. I don't know if it'll get much worse. But I would say that it may not seem like this from the outside. There still is quite a bit of space for criticizing the government right now. And there has been, even over the last couple years. It's just certain issues are kind of red lines. And one of those issues is like insulting Erdogan. That could trigger big problems for you. And another red line is, you know, expressing any kind of too much support or sympathy for the Kurdish rebels and the Kurdish rebellion that is sort of simmering in the country's southeast.
And of course, there's also the war next door in Syria. I mean, Turkish troops have crossed the border to pursue Kurdish fighters on the Syrian side. But Turkish troops going into Syria puts Turkey at odds with the U.S., which supports the Kurdish fighters battling ISIS in Syria. How's Erdogan's victory likely to impact that difficult situation?
I'm not sure if it's going to impact it. I think that that whole process of the U.S. and Turkey trying to work out their issues, I think that that's probably going to continue. The turbulence in the relationship, as one analyst described it to me, is likely to continue. I think that it's just going to be fits and starts between the U.S., but the general trend appears to be tolerance of each other's whims, but occasional lapses in decorum and disagreements over very substantive issues.
Borzu, as we've been talking, you've been conveying that much of what Erdogan is doing, he's going to continue to do. Given that that's what's going on, what is the real significance of his victory?
I think it's a kind of body blow, potentially, to Turkey's democratic path. And I think it would have been so much better if it was a more ambivalent victory for Erdogan instead of this very, you know, kind of clear-cut victory, because it might have forced him to compromise with his opponents. And I think that's just very good for a country, and that would help contribute to the democratic development and institutions in the country. And instead, what you're going to get is this very continuation of this very majoritarian view of democracy. Erdogan has 50+1% of the votes, so he can do whatever he wants.
Borzu Dargahi in Istanbul. Thanks a lot, Borzu.
It's been a pleasure.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. If you've been following the Men's Soccer World Cup in Russia, you've probably heard that the team from Argentina is on the brink of being eliminated after a couple of very disappointing matches. This despite the fact that Argentina has one of soccer's biggest names, Leo Messi, on its roster. Fans of the team are desperate about this. And I'm not just talking about fans back in South America, because Argentina's soccer squad has fans all over the globe, including, as we're about to hear, in Kolkata, India. My BBC colleague Raul Tandon is there, and he reports that fans in Kolkata have a soft spot for South America's two soccer giants, Argentina and Brazil. His story begins with a visit to one man's home on the outskirts of the city.
There's quite a crowd outside Shiv Shankar Putra's tea stall because he's painted it and the three-story house I can see gleaming in front of me blue and white, the colors of his favorite team.
Argentina ki ami bhalobashi.
The Argentinian team is my life. I love Messi. He's like my big brother. So to show my love for him, I have painted my house blue and white. I hope it brings them luck.
So I've just got inside and guess what? It's blue and white as well, with pictures of Messi everywhere. I've left the village and I'm back in Kolkata. And on this street, there is a sight that you can see across this city. There are Brazil and Argentinian flags everywhere.
So my name is Tathagata Banerjee. If you ask me, like, why am I a Brazil supporter? My entire family, all of them are Brazil supporter.
If Brazil were to play India, what would happen?
No, I don't want to answer this. You know, there are some nights when I think about this, what would happen? Who would I support? And I just fell asleep. I said, no, I don't want to. I must go to sleep now.
Time to wake up and give us an answer.
Maybe Brazil.
A fan of Brazil's World Cup soccer team, speaking there with the BBC's Raul Tandon in Kolkata, India. The world's Brandy Fullwood has been following a different South American team at the World Cup. Colombia looked impressive in a 3-0 victory over Poland yesterday, and music from the region around Colombia features in Brandy's latest A-side B-side segment.
The A-side. It's the late 60s and Smithsonian Folkways is exploring the Pacific lowlands. That's Panama, Ecuador, and Colombia. In Colombia, the Pacific Coast, or El Pacifico, is the only place in Colombia with a predominantly black majority population. The Smithsonian makes their album and titles it Afro-Hispanic Music from West Colombia and Ecuador. On the opening track, Norman Witten Jr. records Curulao Bambuco with a few musicians from the city Buenaventura. In this song, you hear the steady hit of the bombo, a large double-headed drum, and this persistent shaking of maracas and guasas. Oh, and also this really lovely glimmer of a wooden xylophone. The title of the song, Curulao Bambuco, is redundant. Curulao is the genre, and it's formally known as bambuco. The music is closely tied to an African origin, and they make use of woodwind instruments, African drums, marimba, and dance. It's a song for courtship. Underneath this shimmering sound, you can barely hear the scuffle of feet brush against flutes and sharp extended vowels. The Smithsonian liner notes mention that people in this recording are also dancing. Okay, and flirting. There's like a lot of flirting. Sometimes Curulao brings in elements of strength and ancestry. Just as the song ends, there's a loop pattern and accented singing. A persistent drum beat and a rush of excitement in the woodwind section. And it kind of sounds like your heartbeat and breath after dancing. That rush of excitement and celebration is key to understanding the connection to the B-side. So, for the B-side, we take those same drum rhythms, a chant, and add some horns, highlights of marimba and curulao influence, and that's Colombia Caribe by Chuck Kiptown, a blend of new and old sounds. Back to the action, toma. Esta gente la fácil, en serio, no es broma. Tenemos el ritmo, tenemos la clave. Afro-colombiano con sabor, ya tú sabes. This is a World Cup dedication. And it's just one of the songs dedicated to Colombia this year. Colombia Caribe is a rush of fanfare and pre-celebration, spanning hip-hop, dancehall, funk, salsa, and of course, traditional sounds from the Pacific region. But in between those sounds is a message about Afro-Latinidad. The group, Chuck Kiptown, is an Afro-Colombian hip-hop group founded in Quibdó, the capital city of the Chocó region in Colombia. Goyo, Tostao, and Slow make up the three-person group, and where there are lyrics about coming together, there are also very clear critiques about anti-blackness. Goyo's verse being this great melodic and vigorous delivery is a great example of that.
lo bueno no gana. Malicia indígena latinoamericana. Me dice afrocolombiana. Yo soy negra y lo digo porque me da la gana.
Mira Goyo raps about the misrepresentation of indigenous and black Latinx Americans. She's quick to reclaim her blackness as a good thing. Trump Cape Town has always been outspoken in this way. They recognize the disparity and inequality experienced by black people on the Pacific coast of Colombia compared to other regions. Their songs intentionally blend positive messages with new and traditional sounds. Colombia Caribe extends a history of blackness, the archives of Colombia, into today. And that's where the two songs speak to each other. Each song captures a community coming together, and they're singing with one another, rejoicing in their livelihood, courtships, family, and blackness, in sound and lyric. The Buenaventura musicians from the late 60s melt into today's message from the Choco musicians. Each group bears the weight of a struggle and hyperinflated negative image of black Hispanics that centers on slavery, corruption, or erasure in telenovelas. In Colombia Caribe, Choc Kip Town sculpts a luxurious song that also celebrates heritage and culture. An uplifting time. For the world, I'm Brandy Fullwood.
Brandy's A-side, B-side segments are part of Future Folk, a partnership between the world and Smithsonian Folkways. I'm Carol Hills. Still ahead, LGBT sensitivity training for government officials in Guatemala. Plus,
how exactly do you capture the magic of an improvisational moment inside a brain scanner?
Improv comedians and neuroscientists teamed up to find out. Those stories coming up here on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Compared to a couple of generations ago, we know quite a bit about how the human brain works, how it processes thought and emotion, how it directs the body to act. There's also plenty we don't know. Ari Daniel from our partner program NOVA has been considering this. Here he is with Marco Werman.
Ari, I know you've been taking a look at how the brain functions for a specific trait of human behavior.
Yes, and here's an example of that trait.
Now let's go to a game called Scene to Rap. Greg and Wayne, you're going to make up a scene.
All right, that's the TV show I used to love. Whose line is it anyway? Whenever there are reruns, I still love it.
Yeah, it's an improv comedy show.
And what I need from the audience is a real or made-up disaster movie. Black Hole. So that's the disaster movie is about a black hole. Space, get out of my face. Ever been in stars all over the place? I'm real scared, I'm getting kind of freaky. I think the ship is getting kind of leaky. I don't know what's out there, it can't be matter. I'm gonna freak out and then go splatter.
Wait a second, wait, have fun. It's only a black hole, I've got one. You gotta realize.
I gotta say, whenever I see Whose Line Is It Anyway, I'm so jealous because these guys are so quick.
They're so quick. I mean, they just, how does it come to them that fast? And in that clip, actually, it combines two kinds of improv. There's the comedy improv, but then also the freestyle rapping improv,
right,
where they're rhyming.
And is there a connection, Ari, between these two types of improv? And what about jazz improvisation?
Well, there are people trying to figure that out, whether there's something in particular that's going on in the brain when it processes thought instantly and turns it into words or music or rhythm. So, Marco, I want to introduce you to Anthony Veneziale. He's a master beatboxer, among other things.
Yeah, I would say I am a professional improviser. I've done improv and comedy for over 20 years now.
These days, he spends a lot of time as a producer and director of a group called Speechless, a live improvised PowerPoint show. And he's quite proud, understandably so, of another show he created called Freestyle Love Supreme,
which is an improvised freestyle rap concert. And I did that along with a couple of dear friends who have gone on to make very big things.
Like Chris Jackson, David Diggs, and Lin-Manuel Miranda. A night or two before I spoke with Veneziale, I was browsing YouTube and bumped into a video featuring Freestyle Love Supreme. And it blew me away.
Ladies and gentlemen, the word is sunrise.
The song begins. The only rule is it has to center around the word sunrise.
Sunrise! Sunrise! Nothing makes me feel so good as a sunrise.
It's gorgeous, it's nuanced, and it's completely improvised.
Okay, growing up in Maryland as an Indian, struggling.
But my favorite part is this guy, Utkarsh Ambudkar.
I'm trying to get a girl to remember my name. Hard game when you skinny with a brown colored frame in the middle of the world and you can't get a girl and you can't get the grades and everything.
He's creating rhyming lyrics on the fly and he's doing it so damn quickly.
In the face and I go to outer space because I want to run away. What do I do? These people don't even know what is a Hindu. Are you black or are you white? We can't tell what color.
And then he gets to this part.
I always felt like I'm an other, so I went to a father. Went to my mother, looked him in the eye, said, I'm tired of this disguise, tired of feeling low. They looked at me and said, son, you gonna grow, son, you gonna rise, son, you gonna grow, son, you gonna be whatever you want, bro, son, you gonna be on stage being a pro, spitting all day upon the microphone, son, you gonna rise, son, you gonna fly, son, you gonna reach the sun, moon, and the skies, son, you gonna be. So say your name even louder, sunrise.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It was incredible.
We all were just, our faces all melted off for that one. Utkarsh, like, just takes it to a whole nother level. And I think all of us, while we were taping that segment, were like, did that just happen? Because it feels like you're pulling off this magic trick.
Can you just kind of describe what it feels like when you're improvising? Like, what exactly is happening inside your head?
There's some kind of switch where I'm like, let's let all the doors open in the brain. Let's like let everything sort of just go and don't judge any of those impulses. And I think what's happening is I've gotten pretty good at allowing this part of my brain called the medial prefrontal cortex have a little bit more rein there, which allows for more self-expression and more doors to be opened. And I've been able to kind of start muting that other part of your brain where your sort of inner critic comes out. I think that's the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex.
This is the neurosciences building that we're just entering now.
The day I interviewed him, he was being accompanied by research assistant Lauren Jacobs into an fMRI machine, a functional magnetic resonance imaging machine.
And we'll head down the hallway on the right.
So you're demetalled?
I'm demetalled.
Okay.
Time now to introduce you to someone else, Charles Lim.
I'm sort of the director of the hearing and hearing loss clinical efforts here at University of California, San Francisco.
Lim is an otolaryngologist. It's an ENT, an ear, nose, and throat doctor. And in addition to all that, he's got a thing for music.
I've kind of had a lifelong obsession ever since I remember being alive, really. I started off on piano, but then I switched to saxophone when I was in middle school. you know, my house looks like a music store. I've got about, I don't know, 60 instruments or something in my house of various kinds. And so I'll kind of play anything I can get my hands on. So I have been playing jazz. I never stopped. And so it's something I do almost all the time, even today.
For instance, here's a song that Lim wrote and performed.
And the older I got, the more and more I was obsessed with this idea of trying to understand music.
Hence his desire to become a hearing specialist.
I found myself at the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, where I was doing functional brain imaging. I started to see that there might be an opportunity to look at the creative brain in action if we did functional MRI scanning of jazz musicians.
Lim wound up doing this study, and here's what he and his colleagues found.
When a musician switches from a memorized state where they're playing something, let's say the melody of a tune, and they start improvising on that tune, a major change in functional activity of the brain takes place. The creative brain, especially in a sort of spontaneously creative state like jazz improvisation, is shutting off big parts of the conscious self-monitoring apparatus in order to allow the unimpeded flow of novel ideas.
And it's not just jazz musicians who get into this flow state.
It doesn't take very much to see the parallels between what a great jazz musician is doing and a great comedian is doing. This whole concept of spontaneous flow and immediate improvisation, I think freestyle rap is another one.
Charles Lim wanted to know how what he saw in the brains of those jazz musicians compares to the brains of other improvisational artists, to see what's the same and what's different inside people's minds as they create on the fly. For a while, this was nothing more than an idea for Lim, until Chicago's Second City, an improvisational theater troupe, got in touch with him.
I got an inquiry asking me to come visit them because they were interested in my research and they wanted to know more about it, and I was like, well, this is perfect.
Lim went to one of their classes and a couple of their shows. It got him fired up. And this was right around the time that he moved to San Francisco. And when that happened, Anthony Veneziale, our professional improviser from before, got in touch.
I sent him an email and I was like, "Dear Charles Lim, you are the best human being that I know. Can I take you to lunch?" And he had just moved here. So luckily he didn't have that many friends in San Francisco yet. And he was like, "Sure, I'd love to meet up." And it was just one of those, you get to meet with your hero, A, and then B, you get to hear that they're interested in all the things that you're interested in. And then I think it's that sort of like stepbrother moment where you're like, did we just become best friends? Yep. We just got to talking and yeah, what can I say? The bromance is alive.
It's out of this bromance that the current fMRI research study blossomed. Granted, it took some iterating.
We then said, let's figure out what might make sense inside of a functional magnetic resonance imaging machine, because you're not going to see too many improv scenes happening in an fMRI, just in terms of the cost alone, but also the staging is hard.
You have to realize that you're doing a science experiment. You're not putting on a show. And so you have to find that sweet spot between designing an experiment that feels kind of like what it naturally feels like to do that activity, but also one that is controlled, structured, and scientifically rigorous enough that you can actually gain meaningful data.
It took a lot of work to get it right. How exactly do you capture the magic of an improvisational moment inside a brain scanner? How do you isolate the creative impulse? Ultimately, they did develop something they were happy with. The resulting study consists of pairs of tasks, one that relies on spontaneous improvisational thinking, and another, the control, that depends on information that's been memorized. This allows for a straightforward comparison of the subject's brain when performing the two tasks.
You need to have a control condition where you can almost subtract that stuff out so that what's left over is kind of creativity, so to speak.
Which brings us back to Veneziale inside the fMRI.
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can indeed. All right. So we'll start the initial scan. Gives us a nice baseline of his brain.
This is Lauren Jacobs again, who works in Charles Lim's lab. The baseline scan takes 5 minutes to execute. Once it's complete, the experiment begins in earnest.
Okay, how you doing, Anthony?
Doing great. How are you?
I'm doing well. Okay, just as a reminder, the first game we're going to be playing is Yes And. And so you'll hear four sentences that begin with the first half of a well-known saying. For the control, we want you to respond with Yes and then the full idiom. For the improv section, just go ahead and do whatever you want, as long as you're saying Yes and use one word from the sentence you heard. Sound good?
Yep.
One of the idioms begins with roses are red. Jacobs offers, roses are red like the velvet curtains in the theater. First, Veneziale responds improvisationally.
Yes, and the theater is the magical dreamscape of your mind. Yes, and red velvet cake is my favorite.
Then he responds with the expected second half of the idiom.
Yes, and roses are red and violets are blue.
The scan takes about an hour, and Veneziale is just one of numerous improv comedians taking part in the experiment.
So we're very much in the preliminary phases of looking at data.
Charles Lim again.
But I will tell you this, we're seeing vast differences between the improvising comedian's brain and the memorized comedian's brain, sort of in the way that we saw big differences between the jazz musician's brain. And so we're quite convinced that the state of creativity is a different functional brain state, and it's measurable, and that these comedians are a fantastic kind of population of people to look at this intriguing question within.
Ari, that's some fascinating reporting, but what, if anything, is the takeaway here? Like, for those of us who aren't professional improvisers or jazz musicians?
I think there are two, actually. So for one thing, Marco, these studies have a lot to say about language, which for all of us is an improvisational medium. Conversations that we have tend to be generated spontaneously in the moment. We're doing this every day, and Lim thinks our conversations engage the brain in the same way as the professionals do when they improvise. But there's something else, something that goes well beyond language, Lim says.
Think about when you drive home from work. You're improvising your way through the traffic and the, you know, twists and turns that happen. You know which general direction you're going to go in, but you don't quite know what you're going to be doing any particular given moment of the drive or whatever it might be. And so there's so many forms of improvisation that it might not be great art, but it's still pretty remarkable that the brain can do it. And I think that the artistic versions are just the finest versions that the human brain can produce.
And, you know, Marco, Lim really likes the idea of people improvising or trying to improvise more in their daily lives, since it seems to have real impacts on the brain.
So far, we've seen that the creative brain is generally a more activated brain than the non-creative brain in the areas that process language and in the areas that process sensory stimuli. To me, it's a really strong argument. It's not proof, but it's a strong argument that we should not be eliminating the arts or creative activities from things like school systems and educational plans. This is how our brains learn to generate new ideas and new solutions to problems that we didn't even know existed.
Wow. That was a great point he made there. And what a great bit of reporting from you, Ari. It made me realize how much I improvise every day, from, you know, writing a text to
beatboxing
to what I cook for dinner. Anyway, thanks very much for this. Ari Daniel, with our partner program Nova, you can hear a longer version of his report on improv and the brain on our podcast, The World in Words. Ari Daniel, thanks.
Thank you, Marco.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World. There are very few legal protections for LGBT people in Guatemala, but some activists in the Central American nation are trying to change that without going through the legislature. Sarah Barrett tells us about one program that aims to educate police and government officials about the LGBT community.
A few months ago, Banner Morales went to the bank. He saw a couple acquaintances, said hi, made small talk, and cashed his check. Later, he learned that rumors were spreading about him. One of the employees at the bank who knew Morales gossiped to a colleague, revealing that Morales is a transgender man. The two employees went through his file and found his identification that still lists female despite his male appearance. Guatemala does not allow transgender people to change their sex on their legal documents. Furious at this invasion of privacy, he decided to file a criminal complaint. He went to the Office of Human Rights and then was sent to the federal prosecutor's office.
No saben que es un hombre trans. Entonces a mí me tocó que explicarle lo que es un hombre trans.
They don't know what a trans man is, so it was my job to explain it to them. And they asked me if a trans man is the same as a lesbian, or if I'm a man that wants to become a woman.
It was humiliating for Morales, but he explained what gender identity is anyway and asked to file the report against the bank. But the employees at the prosecutor's office told him he didn't think a crime had been committed.
Le dije, ¿cómo es eso que están sacando las pruebas del banco? O sea, eso es un delito, le dije. O para una extorsión o para algo. Pero usted lo extorsionaron. No, no me están extorsionando. Entonces no hay delito.
I told him that they went through my personal information. That's a crime. It could be for extortion or something. And he said, but are they blackmailing you? No, they're not blackmailing me, I told him, but they're not allowed to reveal my personal information. No, 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 he said. This case has no merit. There's no crime. There's nothing here. Until something actually happens, it's just gossip. So until someone rapes me or kills me or fires me from work, until then, it's not a crime? And he told me, I'm sorry, but for people like you, there is no law.
This is the kind of situation that advocates are trying to fix. Meet Carlos Romero Prieto. He works for Lambda, an LGBT rights organization, contracted by the Federal Prosecutor's Office to train government employees and police about LGBT sensitivity. Today, he's leading a class of 21 adults in what basically amounts to a sex ed course in a conference room in a hotel in Guatemala's capital. They've trained a little more than 800 people in 4 years all over the country, from the capital to the countryside. Romero asks the class to introduce themselves one at a time, their name, where they're from, and something about their sexuality.
Sexualidad, no genitalidad.
The class instantly dissolves into awkward laughs. There's also some uncomfortable silence. They each take turns.
Yo no sé qué es sexualidad.
The class laughs as one woman admits she isn't sure what sexuality means. And everyone claps loudly when one guy proclaims himself a man who likes men. They play a quick icebreaker. The class is split in two, Earthlings and Martians. Half the class puts on light-up headbands. They're told they know nothing about humans, and it's Earthlings' job to describe humanity, sexuality and all.
¿Qué es sexo?
La diferencia biológicamente entre la vagina y el pene.
No me quedó
claro.
Fundamental.
Then everyone takes out a pen to fill out a preliminary test about gender identity and sexual orientation to get a base level of the class's understanding of LGBT issues. These government employees work for the prosecutor's office. They are the first line of reception for people who want to file a claim of wrongdoing or abuse. They're the people that Benner Morales was rejected by. Sofia Crosa works for the Attorney General's office investigating child abuse. I ask her a couple of questions from the test. What do you understand about gender?
La diferencia que existe entre hombre y mujer.
It's the difference between men and women.
What do you understand about sex?
Atributos para los seres humanos para diferenciar los hombres de las mujeres.
It's the human attributes that differentiate men and women.
Her grasp of LGBT issues isn't quite up to Romero's standards. The answers he was looking for are gender is a social construct, and sex is the physical and biological characteristics of a person. Crosta has never learned about LGBT issues before, not at school, nor is training for her job. That's a common experience among the trainees. Guatemala is a conservative country. But this classroom is a safe space for questions. One person asks, is it possible for a trans man to get pregnant? Another struggled with the difference between gender and sex. And another trainee raised her hand to ask, what does queer mean?
El queer es una teoría.
Romero projects YouTube onto a wall and plays the music video for Queen's I Want to Break Free. People dance along in their seats as he talks about how the music video celebrates queer identities. Next, he plays a music video without sound and asks the class what gender they assume the singer is. Then he raises the volume and says it's a woman who has male performativity. It wasn't all fun and games, though. To drive home a point about LGBT lives being in danger in this country, Romero plays a grainy surveillance video that shows two men sitting in a bar, holding hands, and then a man walks in, pulls out a gun, and shoots them point blank. It's horrifying. Romero goes on to say that queer people shouldn't be in danger just for holding hands, being themselves, and walking down the street. But one student pushes back. He's the one who proclaimed he's a man who likes men. He says no. He says he's gay, but he keeps it behind closed doors.
Sorry for the interruption, but that's where society doesn't see things correctly. For example, I've shared with many people, and everybody has respected my life and my sexual orientation. How am I supposed to succeed? By behaving myself.
Romero says that kind of sentiment is unfortunately common.
Yo creo que justo, yo creo que es un mecanismo de defensa. Y justo yo lo decía, hay mecanismos de defensa y al final también terminamos introyectando.
I think it's a defense mechanism, trying to be the correct gay, the white middle class gay that behaves himself. But we have to legitimize that any kind of expression is good, that all forms of expression also come with the guarantee of human rights. But whoever wants to put on a costume and walk down the street with cymbals and a big bass drum screaming that I'm a queer, I'm a queen, I'm a fag, I'm a Nancy, they should do it.
Romero says it's an uphill battle, and things won't change overnight. But hopefully, little by little, these lessons will stick and it'll get easier. For The World, Sarah Barrett, Guatemala City, Guatemala.
That's our show today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.